Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on listen-only. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one. I'd like to inform participants that today's call is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to your conference host today, Mr. Joseph Lugo. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you so much, and welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. This is the Aging and Disability Resource Center program teleconference call. Wanted to walk real quick through the agenda to give you a sense on how the call is going to be managed. First, we're just going to have some introductory comments from the administration from Community Living, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and then our partners at the Veterans Health Administration. After those introductory comments, we will then open it up for questions and answers. We're going to first take questions for Part B of the funding opportunity, and we will address those questions in their entirety, and then we will move on to Part A, questions and answer period. So this call is scheduled for 1 hour. We're scheduled to close at 2 o'clock. Any questions that were unable to be answered, we'll make sure to post and put on our frequently asked questions running list. So if everyone is ready to go, I'll turn this over to John Wren, our first speaker.
Thank you, Joseph, and thank you, everybody, for joining us on the call today. The Aging and Disability Resource Center funding opportunity represents the first major funding announcement to come out of the Administration for Community Living, the newest agency within the Department of Health and Human Services, but it truly reflects a partnership across the federal government with our colleagues from CMS and the Veterans Health Administration who are with us on the call today. There are actually two funding opportunities available under this announcement. One to all 48 existing ADRC grantees that are eligible to apply for 1 year extension grants, and then a second targeted at what we're calling the Enhanced ADRC Options Counseling Program, which is designed to support the work of up to eight states at $2.3 million over a three-year period to actually demonstrate as national models how the vision of the ADRC program can be achieved fully. And that vision is laid out in the program announcement, and it includes four key components. One, consistent with the new constituency represented by the Agency for Community Living, we now have pulled together in one agency responsibility for three populations, including seniors, people with physical disabilities, and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Those are the minimum targets for coverage under this enhanced options counseling grant program. So by the end of the 3 years, we expect those states to have full statewide coverage of an ADRC options counseling program that serves all three of those populations. Other populations can be served, but those are the minimum expectations. To accommodate this and to reflect the learnings from past ADRC investments, we are officially moving to a no-wrong-door approach under this announcement that will broaden the involvement of a wide range of agencies and organizations that can appropriately and effectively play a role in serving the populations we're expecting to be covered under the enhanced grants. We are also building on the work that we have done with 19 states over the past 3 years that have developed draft national standards for options counseling. We will take those draft standards and work with the eight funded states under the enhanced program to finalize those standards and to translate them into a national training and certification program. We will also look to these eight high-performing states to actually achieve financial sustainability over the long term within the 3 years that they receive funding. This will require them to demonstrate how they can leverage Older Americans Act funds, general state revenue funds, Medicaid, FFP, and FMAP, as well as Veterans Health Administration funds to create a fully sustainable ADRC options counseling program nation or statewide. And then finally, we will be working with the eight states to develop a national evaluation framework that will delineate specific outcomes, metrics, and data we expect will be used by the eight states and eventually nationwide to effectively evaluate how well the states are doing and the ADRCs within those states are doing to achieve the milestones and outcomes laid out in this program announcement, and to be able to continuously fine-tune and improve the performance of the ADRC program nationwide. So that is in a broad stroke fashion the intent of this funding announcement, and I will now turn it over to my colleague at CMS, Effie George.
Great. Hi, everyone. Thank you, John, for the nice introduction. My name is Effie George, and I work for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and it was a privilege and honor to partner very closely with the Administration for Community Living and our partners at the Veterans Health Administration on this joint announcement that was recently released. That said, we, including CMS, we all support the goal of states developing sustainable, no-wrong-door, single-entry-point models for providing long-term services and supports options counseling that streamline assessment, eligibility determination, enrollment, service initiation, data collection, and reporting across all public programs that pay for long-term services and supports. As our states undergo health systems transformation and long-term care rebalancing / balancing activities, development of sustainable infrastructure is critical to ensure ongoing coordinated access to services. We hope that states and other stakeholders within states can help encourage states to consider how this funding opportunity can supplement existing state efforts to increase broader transformation of their health and long-term services and supports delivery system through an enhanced ADRC program model. On June 5th, I think that was even last week, our center director for the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services, Cindy Mann, released an informational bulletin to help increase support of this opportunity. The goal of this informational bulletin was to point out, particularly for our Medicaid partners, that this funding announcement is in complete alignment with where we're moving as an agency and also several initiatives in particular. The several initiatives in particular that this is perfectly coordinated with is the Money Follows the Person demonstration that I bet you've heard about, and also the recent Balancing Incentive Program, which is up and running in New Hampshire, Maryland, and soon a couple more states. This funding announcement can help support one of the structural change requirements under the Balancing Incentive Program, which is the No Wrong Door Single Entry Point requirement. So we've heard loud and clear that it's very important that people like the same definitions for the same term used throughout programs, and that's what we have to offer through this funding announcement is some very close alignment of our programs. So we hope very much that you'll take advantage of these exciting opportunities. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Dan Sheps at the Veterans Health Administration.
Effie, thank you. As we look at this funding opportunity, we recognize VA operating network offices VA medical centers and the aging and disability networks for their partnership, innovation, and drive to expand access to home and community-based services through our self-directed program, Veteran-Directed Home and Community-Based Services. Together, we have served over 1,400 veterans and their families, with approximately 17% of those veterans being under the age of 60. Programs are operational through the partnership at 38 VA medical centers across 15 of the 21 VA operating networks and 91 aging and disability resource centers, area agencies on aging, and centers for independent living. VA's national vision and support of this joint announcement and our investment align with the concepts of no wrong door, single entry point. It expresses a belief that options counselors will play a pivotal role in helping veterans access and obtain HCBS services that they need. VHA is pleased to join the Administration for Community Living and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to work with 8 states to develop an all-payer, all-ages, no-wrong-door, single-entry point for long-term services and supports. VA is working to rebalance our system of long-term services and supports by expanding access to home and community-based services. In addition, we must take greater care in providing veterans with greater choice and control over their own use of long-term services and supports, particularly home and community-based services. VA is looking for 2 things through this funding opportunity. One is a concerted effort to expand veteran-directed home and community-based services. It is imperative that we move forward with this initiative and reach as many medical centers as we can. The second, and this is new in this funding opportunity, is to replicate the approach that we've taken with Veteran Directed and apply it to purchased HCBS services through the Aging and Disability Networks. VA will provide in the 8 states that receive this funding opportunity, again described in Attachment H, the opportunity of to develop these new processes, again, based on what we've done in home and community-based services under Veteran Directed. 4 things stand out, 4 items. A standardized assessment, which will use a single assessment tool across the country. The second item that is critical to us is person-centered planning. And then the administrative processes of setting a plan with the veteran to purchase services, a schedule to provide oversight to ensure that the purchased services are received, and then to invoice the VA for the services provided. We are greatly pleased to join ACL and CMS and ultimately the 8 selected states and the ADRC's area agencies on aging and Centers for Independent Living in these states to develop and operate this system to streamline access to long-term services and supports for veterans. Thank you. And back to Joseph.
Thank you so much, Dan and Effie. Our final speaker will be Mimi Toomey from the Administration for Community Living.
Hi, I'll be very quick. I believe there's probably a lot of questions out there. I just wanted to point people to Attachment M, which starts on page 153 of the program announcement. It's other federal opportunities that may align with ADRCs. Effie referenced a couple of those through Money Follows the Person. But through this attachment, there are 35 potential demos or initiatives or programs that could align very closely with this opportunity. We want to ensure that the greatest impact and coordination between the federal funding and activities related to systems transformation, states are encouraged to evaluate and align their reform activities across a broad array of options. So in this attachment, you can click on to what is going on in what states around some of these activities. So we just wanted to highlight this. There's a lot going on in states already. We know that. We just think this is a good opportunity for states to really tie it all together. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Mimi. So we would like to open up questions. As John mentioned, there are two parts of this funding opportunity. There's a Part A, the Enhanced ADRC Options Counseling Program, and a Part B, ADRC Sustainability Program Expansion Supplemental Opportunity. What we'd like to do is focus on Part B for right now and take any questions related to that particular funding opportunity. So, Trey, if you're available, if you could open up the line.
Yes, thank you. At this time, we're ready to begin the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1, and you'll be announced prior to asking. To withdraw your question, press star 2. Once again, at this time, to ask an audio question, please press star 1. Our first question does come from Patricia Stemmerman. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my question. We are a for-profit franchise care system across the United States, and we have been working developing a program called Right Transitions to take care of the folks who will be leading the hospitals now, and as you all know, the hospital will not get paid for a second admission if they come back in 30-day time. My question to you is, who do you foresee fulfilling the home and community health services that are going to be needed to either take these folks home or to coordinate them to perhaps a facility?
Thank you, Patricia, and thank you for your question. And as you were asking it, there are a number of individuals in the room nodding their head agreeing with your comments. In particular, John Wren mentioned the work that's been done through our evidence-based care transition program. So through that, we've been able to demonstrate, I feel, that through these ADRC programs, some very effective and impact results on helping transition people from hospitals.
And that applies to what is going on through CMS under 3026, the Community-Based Care Transitions Program. We're working again with our partners on the Medicare side on that activity. And so far, and I'm sure you're very aware of this given the work that you're doing, Patricia, 39 program awards have been made. And primarily, a lot of those are with the Aging and Disability Resource Centers, the AAAs, and in partnership with the SILS.
And we do expect that in the enhanced ADRC program, there has to be evidence-based care transitions in at least one area, and we're assuming that many of the current grantees will continue to play a role in this important area. So thank you for your question.
Sure. Thank you for your answers. I appreciate it. Just one quick question. How would an organization such as ours go about partnering with the ADRCs?
There's actually multiple ways to do that, and we can talk further offline if you would like. The shortest way, you can actually There are multiple ways to find your local ADRC in your state, whether you reach out to the adrc-ta.org website. You can click on your respective state and find your local ADRC. If you reach out to your local state on aging or the elder care locator, both of those are the ways to do that. But I'd be happy to talk further offline to get you connected and partner up.
Sure. And what was your name again?
It's Joseph Lugo, L-U-G-O. And my email address is in the announcement.
Yes, I saw that. Thank you so much.
Quite welcome. Next question.
Yes, next question does come from Nancy Field. Your line is open.
Hi. I have a very quick question. In the Part B portion of the grant, are there specific VA funds that will be attached to that portion of the grant where it's attached to the Part A piece?
Not specifically tied to it. I mean, as Dan mentioned, there is a national reach. They're trying to reach all VA AMCs nationally, so if one of those states in Part B will most likely have active relationship with the local VA AMC. It may not be part of the targeted funds in Part A, but it doesn't exclude you from participating in the VA AMC program.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Nancy.
Our next question does come from Gina Rossi. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking my question. In this state, we are in two different agencies, the State Unit on Aging and the Medicaid unit is separate. And so currently the state Medicaid unit is in charge of, we manage the long-term care single point of entry. And we kind of use the terms differently, single point of entry not necessarily being no wrong door from what I look at the way you have it defined here. Is it possible for this grant to consider the ADRC as one of the vehicles into the current single point of entry process? Or does the ADRC model have to be the only entry into the process?
A couple answers for that, because it sounds like there are a couple questions in that. And it's actually a question we have received from some states. If a state is managing multiple ADRC grants, who would be eligible? For the Part B announcement, it's the state entity that's received the 2009 AOA ADRC grant. So that would be the entity that would be eligible. But it's only one application per state for each announcement. So for Part B, it would just be one application. In terms of your other question, in terms of can ADRC be part of other organizations that feed into a single point of entry, actually in the Part A announcement, we kind of laid out in a way, in our best description that we could come up with in terms of how a no-wrong-door system would function, and how an entity could decide whether they want to just be kind of an ADRC access point or something above and beyond that. So that's probably the best place to look in terms of the guidance that we've given states. Does that help?
I'd like a little bit more clarification, and it sounds like this has come up before. So
let me also try to elaborate. This is John Wren. What we're looking for in the eight states is a single access system. So that is tied together and supported by all the major public funding streams as a single system. As Joseph has just said, the announcement lays out the tremendous degree of flexibility states have in designing the different components of that system. But we would not, application that came in and reflected multiple access systems in a state would not score favorably.
Okay, that's clear. Thank you.
Our next question does come from Debbie Walter. Your line is open.
Thank you. We were a little bit confused about what exactly the eligible expenses for Part B were. Are we allowed, for example, to hire additional ADRC staff through that funding if we were to receive that? What we would want to do is expand our options counselors across our state. We already have only one access point for the ADRC. We just have one.
Yes, it is an expansion component. It would be a continuation of your existing ADRC grant.
So okay.
The activities you were allowed to do in the previous grant, you'd be allowed to continue to do it in this supplemental.
Okay. That was a little bit confusing to myself and my administrators. And then I have some questions for A, but I'll wait until then.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question does come from Ruth Palumbo. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Carol Malone, actually, here in Massachusetts with Ruth Palumbo. I have a question just general overall. We were one of the 19 states who participated in the last grant, the 2009 grant, and in all of the calls and development work on the National Options Counseling Standards. And as many of you know, our state's Options Counseling Program has been in existence since 2008 when it was first piloted in three sections of the state, three regions, excuse me, and it is now statewide. Our options counselors already participate in state-required training, and we do have state standards. How would a program like ours that already is solidified in our 11 ADRCs regionally participate in this funding opportunity, specifically as you lay out the assessment, screening requirements, and those are accomplished in Massachusetts via other services and programs?
Yeah, from your description, it sounds like you'd be definitely a leader or a mentor in the process, and we would work with you on learning what you've learned or your experiences through that process. I think some areas that we would look at too is how you're just defining your population. Is the options counseling you're providing, is it encompass the populations that we described within this announcement? But it sounds like you are doing all the things that you need to do.
And again, part of the intent of the this announcement targeted at the enhanced Part A grants will be a collaborative effort on the part of the federal partners working with the funded states to come to an agreement on, given the national standards, what is the best form and content for a national training and certification program. So you and other states that have experience already in developing and implementing standards and training and certification programs should highlight that in your applications.
I have a follow-up question.
Okay. It's related to Part B, I'm assuming?
Well, I believe it is related to Part B because Part B, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the way I'm reading it, would also require that options counselors complete the national training and certification.
Part B is actually, that's part of the Part A component. Part B is simply a supplemental opportunity for the 2009 ADRC grantees.
Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome. Next questions related to Part B?
Yes, our next question comes from Lisa Druin. Your line is open.
Actually, sorry, mine is related to Part A, so I can wait.
Okay, we promise we'll get to that very shortly. Any questions related to Part B?
At this time, we show no further questions.
Okay.
Open it up.
You should make sure. Just in closing the Part B section, I just want to reiterate something that was spelled out in the announcement. We are encouraging all 48 states that receive a current ADRC grant to apply for Part B. It is a simple three-page application, and then if you also choose to apply for Part A, if for some reason you're not selected for Part A, you will have Part B funding made available to you. So it's important that all 48 states apply for Part B, whether or not they choose to apply for Part A.
And you will also notice in the announcement that the letters of intent are June 22nd, and the applications are due for Part B on July 11th. But as John mentioned, it is very streamlined, only a three-page application. So let's open it up for Part A. And any questions related to Part A?
At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment for the first question. First question is Janet Valero. Your line is open.
Hi, Janet.
Hi, I tried to press the buttons in time for a Part B question, but it may apply to both. Would it be acceptable to use the funds for purchasing data systems in either part?
Yes, you would be allowed to do so then.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll just weigh in here. Obviously, because this is a program announcement, when we're talking about Part A for all payers and all populations, we would want to see how any investment of these grant dollars are used to leverage and coordinate with grant dollars and revenue streams from other payers, in particular Medicaid. In this case, because we do not want to see duplicative systems.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Lisa Druin. Your line is open.
Thank you. This question is related to the VAMC veteran component. If we are currently providing for one VA medical center in our state, would we be able to expand at that VA medical center as well as connect with new VA medical centers, or are you specifically looking to do the new VA medical centers to this program?
Dan, would you be able to address that?
Yes and yes.
Okay, expand and do new. And so we're targeting as many VA medical centers within the state as possible is the goal?
Yes, and if there's one, obviously we'd be looking for, you know, we'd be looking to cover statewide, which may involve a VA in another state.
Okay.
Thank you, Dan. And
we can work that out, yes.
And then my next question is related to the veteran budget. So the VAMC would receive money for the services that we would then invoice for rather than the VAMCs needing to reallocate existing funds. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Next question does come from Peggy Spalding. Your line is open.
Todd Coffey, actually. In regards to the age groups that these grants are serving, are we to assume that this includes children?
Yes, it includes, it has to include, Part A has to include seniors, people with physical disabilities of all ages, and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities of all ages.
And then a follow-up question with the Administration for Community Living. Is there going to be a way to look back at previous direction to find ways to fund ADRC activities using ACL funding?
Can you repeat that, Todd?
We're trying to find a way to serve the under 60 with existing funding, and with ACL expanding to all ages, is there going to be an allowance to fund ADRC activities for all ages using the funding that we receive?
The grant money being made available under this funding announcement from the ACL, as like the grant money that has been made available in previous years for ADRC from AOA, has always been a funding that has been allowed to be used to serve people with disabilities of all ages.
I guess I'm looking at the sustainability side.
Pardon?
I'm looking at the sustainability side. What areas of funding can we access to pay for ADRC ongoing?
That's a great question. This is Lori Gerhard, Todd. And the this intent of this application or this funding opportunity is really to begin to weave together VA funding for veterans of all ages, Medicaid funding for people of all ages that qualify for the program, as well as potentially even some Medicare funding through Medicare Advantage plans or other types of programs like that.
All payers.
Does that answer your question?
I guess just to ask the question, can we use Older Americans Act dollars to pay for ADRC activities?
Yes.
For all
now,
ages?
For those dollars, they would have to be targeted at ADRC activities that serve persons who are eligible for Older Americans Act services.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Our next question does come from Ed Ahern. Your line is open.
Hey, this is Ed Ahern, and I have a question. It's a couple of parts, if that's possible. I wanted to find out if you had any, if the ACL had any recommendations to calculate potential impact of general fund in increasing options counseling to a statewide coverage. And if there's any recommendations on how we would estimate potential utilization, and how do you recommend we incorporate options counseling into managed care?
Thank you, Ed, for your. I think it's a three-part question, actually. I'll start in order. The first, in terms of statewide impact of having options counseling, that's one of our goals, is to try to work with these eight states to determine what is the impact to have a full statewide system with options counselors that have been trained and certified. So today, we don't really have much data that shows that impact statewide. So our goal would be to work with the states to get that. In terms of your second question about utilization, can you just explain what you mean by that? Utilization of accessing options counselors or...
I think the ops, you know, what levels of anticipated utilization of options counseling, do you have any recommendations to us on how to estimate the level of utilization of options counseling?
Yeah, and actually our hope is that through these applications, states will be telling us. This is the ratio we think of options counselors, you know, their caseload. So our hope is we would get that information from the local level and from the states. We can refer to you or try to post some resources that we've used, but that would be our initial goal.
One factor that we have been sharing with the Veterans Directed Home Community-Based Services program that we learned through that program is that on average, a typical caseload that's manageable is usually 20 to 25 veterans per options counselor for that particular program.
Okay. That's very helpful.
And go ahead.
Next question.
I just wanted to real quickly, Ed, you asked about how these systems can work within managed care. That was that's definitely an issue and a priority within ACL across our partners. Actually, one of the attachments, we're developing an attachment with this announcement specifically on that. Our goal is then to turn that maybe into a white paper or issue brief. But actually, Mimi Toomey has helped leading the charge with some of our national partners on putting out more technical assistance in this area. But it's definitely an appropriate question.
We think there are probably some models out there. We know there are models out there of other partners working with the managed care organizations. And I think one of our goals is to disseminate all of our learnings from this announcement across the state.
So thank you for your questions, Ed. Next one.
Yes, our next question does come from Paula Acosta. Your line is open.
Go ahead, Paula.
Paula, please check your mute button.
Yes, thank you. You're right. I want to thank my very capable partner, Ed, for posing us, but I do have another question, and that has to do with a phased-in approach. I know that the notice included somewhat of a phased-in, but could you elaborate on that a bit? There would be might be a number of ways the phases could be arranged. By source or by numbers or statewideness, so on.
Right, and I think the one of the most critical phases of the Part A announcement is that first 6 months where we're working with the states to finalize not only the evaluation framework and the performance deliverables, but also the training and certification of the options counselors. Through that process, we may do some redesigning, some retooling in terms of the phase-in, but some of those things have been built in.
And yes.
Important thing.
And I want to commend you on the resources you provided in the attachments. They're wonderful, and it will help us make the case when we get together with our Medicaid partners The other thing, just one more short. We've learned quite a bit about options counseling under the pilot project and the work on the standards. This would significantly change the role of options counselors. Could ACL comment on that? And we do have the corrected latest draft.
And that's something maybe we could talk more about, Paula, because our goal or our intent was that this wouldn't be a major change of where options counseling should be or what they should be doing. So we'd be more than happy to talk further about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Next question comes from Debbie Walter. Your line is open.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions regarding this one. The first one is, will if involvement in Part 8, will that necessitate an amendment to our Medicaid state plan? They're in the process of retooling that now, and we wondered if they would have to amend it to include partnering with the ADRC in a more formal way. The other one is participation in a VDA-CBS program a requirement? We are not involved in that yet. We are talking about it and planning to do so, but we're not there yet. And then we also wondered if you could elaborate a little bit on what you're calling the coordinated care delivery model. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Debbie. I'll start with the VDA-CBS question. You do not have to have an active relationship with the VAMC to apply for either of the opportunities. If you look at the review criteria, there is somewhat of an advantage if you have an existing relationship in place. But as part of your application, it could be brand new. You're reaching out to your VAMC partner to apply. So that wouldn't stop you or make you ineligible.
Okay.
In terms of your first question, in terms of needing a maybe an amendment to your Medicaid plan. Effie, did you want to address that at all?
Joseph, could you repeat the initial question?
Can you repeat it, Debbie, so I don't...
Sure. We were wondering if maybe elaborate a little on the Medicaid component, because our Medicaid department is in the process of retooling their Medicaid state plan, and would a more formal partnership between the ADRC program and the Medicaid program necessitate an amendment to their state plan?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
But I definitely, you know, from a Medicaid perspective, the more that, you know, we can link together these state partners, or if you can help us do that, it would be greatly appreciated because they're all interrelated.
Yes.
Efforts.
Yes. Yes,
our goal is exactly right. It is to streamline access and information for beneficiaries in our state of all these programs.
Yes, it is for us too. But
yep.
We wondered whether they would have to, you know, play with it a little bit more before they submit it.
Well, off the top of my head, I don't know why they would, as long as it didn't affect any of the Medicaid services.
Okay.
Or, provided or the eligibility for those services provided, but definitely worth more conversation with your state Medicaid partners.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Great question.
Mm-hmm. Our next question does come from Heather Burkhart. Your line is open.
My question was answered while I was sitting in the queue. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather. I'm glad you joined us.
Our next question comes from Ruth Palumbo. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Carol Malone again here with Ruth Palumbo and Rachel Weiner, and I hope I didn't forget my question just listening to all the answers, but I'll do my best. I'm circling back to the piece on the national training and standards, and again, Massachusetts already has established training curriculum and requirements for options counselors and standards in place. And the way I read the proposal, it sounds as though funded states would have to meet these federal requirements, and that would entail an overhaul of our existing options counseling program, which I think someone else mentioned earlier. Wouldn't this be a change? And we also view this change. There would be a change to our options counseling program.
Let me answer this one and try to clarify again. What our intent is with the eight enhanced options counseling states is to collaborate with those states, leveraging the experience and assets that those states bring to the table to collaborate on the development of a national training and certification program. We're assuming that that program will reflect and be grounded in not only the work of the national standards and the 19 states that have played a significant role in those standards, but the work and current efforts of the eight states that are funded. So I would not assume that if you have a fully developed statewide training and certification program for your options counselors, that there will be major changes in that. What that is it's an asset that you have developed that will be used to help inform a national program. So don't assume that you're going to have to change. We may ask you to add some things that you don't have now that other states might have demonstrated and identified as important. But if you're funded as one of the eight states, you will have a role in shaping the national standards. Does that help, Ruth?
Yeah, you know, no, definitely. It definitely helps. And, you know, you said something that made me think of another question. You may have to ask us to add something, so we would actually be changing our standards, because the draft of the current national standards, again, which we were very much involved in, definitely have elements or components that are not necessarily supported statewide. And what I mean by that is we're not actually functioning fully in that manner, and it would take time to get there to gather consensus throughout our state and our ADRCs and how options counseling is functioning today. So there would be some work there for us. And the certification piece, we do not certify our options counselors. They do have to participate in a training that meets state standards that are defined in contracts with our ADRCs, but there's not a certification process. Today there isn't.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, this is Ruth Palumbo. I have a question about the assessment tool and what you're thinking about in terms of having a standardized assessment. For us in Massachusetts, that's very challenging because our options counselors don't use a standard assessment, and our local agencies through our home care program do the assessments. And the independent living centers do assessments on their clients as well. And so can you talk a little bit about the importance of how you're looking at the standard assessment tool?
The standard assessment tool is something that we are encouraging states to adopt. We are not requiring it.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Stephanie Hull. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you all very much for making this new opportunity available. We deeply appreciate it in Maryland. I have a question. Something was said a minute ago, a few minutes ago. I wanted to just make sure I understand it. Someone said was speaking and said that your options counseling case ratio for veterans was maybe 1 to 25 or 1 to 20, and I wanted to make sure, because we're just bringing up our veterans program, and I was wondering if that would not be more of the case management or supports counselor ratio, because options counseling might not. So I just wondered what you meant by that.
Thanks for the question. This is Lori. So in the Veterans Directed Home and Community-Based Services Program, the options counselors are playing a very robust role, in that they are working with the veteran to assess their needs, to identify what their needs might be, facilitating with that veteran the development of the service plan, and then also working with that veteran, whether they choose, at this point under VDA-CVS, it's self-directed. So working with that veteran in the selection of their caregivers that they're going to employ, making sure that the FMS has the information necessary to process the payroll, and then also assuring that the services are activated, that the veteran is able to activate those services. So it is a full, robust options counseling program that also includes a monthly follow-up and continuing to stay in touch with that veteran and their family and make adjustments along the journey.
Thank you, Laura. Yeah, and so that's just helpful to me because we've been calling that supports counselors in our veterans program, while options counseling has been emerging in through the other grant that we've been working on, and is a more a broader. So we'll have to make sure that's clarified in our submission.
Yeah, thank you. That ratio may change with the applications. Other states may propose different ratios. So we're open to that. Thank you, Stephanie.
Yeah.
Our next question does come from Peggy Spaulding. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Tim Cortez in Colorado. I'm representing the state Medicaid agency. And so I have a couple of questions, and I guess this would go particularly to Effie. So I would imagine that, in our waiver applications, HCBS waiver applications, we have to talk about the administration of the waiver, and we talk about eligibility determination and such. And in a lot of cases, like with ours, we do that through administrative funds that we cover the single entry point functions. So I would imagine that we would probably have to do waiver amendments, correct?
No. I don't think so. And the only reason I say this is because when we were developing our balancing incentive program guidance on the No Wrong Door single entry point system, we made sure we constructed it in a way that would be, encourage states to take us up on these infrastructure building activities without triggering a waiver amendment. So if these activities do not affect the eligibility for services and their provisions, as in restricting eligibility or changing eligibility, that should not trigger a Medicaid waiver amendment because that's certainly not our intent. But again, if there are more specific questions, of course I can't answer for your state Medicaid agency, but I can just tell you at a very high level that certainly wasn't our intent with this guidance, was to trigger.
A second question is, with the creating standards for options counseling, would we expect CMS to come out with guidance related to the use of those standards in terms of how we approach our design of our single entry point systems on the Medicaid side?
Not at this time.
Okay.
The important thing at this point is to reference attachment G, which is a document that we worked very closely with Effie and multiple parties within CMS, including the financial management folks and the Office of General Counsel, to have approved. So that's probably the source of guidance I would start with.
Thank you, Tim. I'm glad you're able to make the call. Any other questions?
Yes, our next question comes from Amy Snyder. Your line is open.
Hi, we were just wondering, we're at New York State and Office for the Aging, and how you would define statewide coverage, because we have our ADRC programs operating on a county-by-county basis versus a regional approach. So we were just wondering if you could provide kind of a definition of how you what you mean by statewide.
Not to make this too simple, but we define it as being statewide, whether it's covering the U.S. or your state population or having all counties served. That's how we define being statewide. Whether you take a county approach or a regional approach, that we're flexible. We don't have to define that. I hope that helps. Is there another follow-up question you had, or?
No, we were just wondering if we would be required to have is functioning in each county of the state, even if there may not be an ADRC program operating in that county.
We'd at least want individuals in that county to have access to the services.
Access. Okay. Yep, that helps. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question does come from Ed Ahern. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for taking my last question, I promise. I'm wondering back to the managed care, do you think it was your intent to include it in options counseling in a capitated rate? Is that up to the states? And is there any perhaps guidance or directives coming from CMS surrounding that?
Could you please repeat the beginning of the question?
I was wondering if options counseling, and as it relates to managed care, if it would, if it would be the goal to have options counseling added as part of the capitated managed care rate, and whether or not CMS, has provided or will provide any guidance surrounding that.
That's a great question. I know here at CMS we are in the process of working on guidance on managed care since so many states are considering it nowadays. I don't know that we will, the guidance will provide that level of specificity, but it's certainly worth something that we should keep talking about. I don't believe it will be up in the first iterations of CMS guidance on managed care, which should be forthcoming this summer.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Good question.
Thank you, Ed. We have a couple minutes left. Any other questions?
Yes, our next question does come from Janet Villarreal. Your line is open.
Hi. I have a question about a state that already has a centralized eligibility determining function within Medicaid. What would be the benefit and an ADRC that feeds into that eligibility function, a central intake unit? What would be the benefit in a state of having the eligibility as part of the ADRC?
You want
Joe? Effie, let me take a stab at this, and then I'll ask you to weigh in. Again, what we're looking for are integrated systems of access that all payers support for all the populations we expect to be covered under this enhanced ADRC program announcement. That doesn't prescribe how the different components of an organized system of access will be put together or managed. We're really leaving that to the states. The important thing is there's one system supported by all payers. How that system is configured, we're leaving that to states to reflect their unique situations and histories and relationships.
Effie, did you want to have any additional comments?
Yes, please. And sure. This is Effie again from CMS, and thanks for your great comments, John. I think one thing that's notable about this funding opportunity, and it's a little bit different from some of our other straight CMS opportunities, is that our partners at ACL and VHA actually pushed our definitions out further to encompass people in states regardless of health insurance type, to make it really a one-stop shop information-wise. So whether people have private insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, both, all three, veterans health insurance, that everybody goes to one place for the information, and that goes beyond the requirements, for instance, of the balancing incentive program that fully supports and recommends this model but only requires states to do it for people with Medicaid coverage only. So that said, it really is an optimal situation that we strongly encourage our states, and by partnering with ACL, this is some potential funding for states to take advantage of and do this model.
Thank you so much, Effie, and both Dan and all, we have our full support in your last statement. Thank you very much.
Okay, and just a follow-up question to that. If that kind of integration didn't necessarily result in any kind of long-term funding stream for the ADRC, is that something that a state is still encouraged to pursue?
Yeah, I think we want the states that apply to be able to have long-term sustainability as a result of after the 3 years. So the funding through either Medicaid or Medicare through various demos, as well as other managed care organizations and the VA. So they would have these different funding streams and not have to rely on the ADRC funds.
Right. I'm just asking if the realignment didn't result in, let's say, a stream of Medicaid money going directly to the ADRC, is that necessarily something to still pursue?
Well, this is Effie, and I think our partners alluded to it earlier from ACL. There is some fresh and updated guidance that came out through this opportunity. So for states, whether you take advantage of this opportunity or not, I would definitely encourage you to look at that guidance because, like they said, our general counsel at CMS reviewed it. It's been updated by the financial management people. And the goal of that guidance on how states can do cost allocation is how it tells states instructions on how to bill Medicaid for the Medicaid people they serve in these single entry point systems. And this is how the states can continue to fund this effort beyond the expiration of these grant funds in an ongoing basis. So, yes, absolutely no time better than the present, and now you have more updated guidance than ever, thanks to our partners.
And just to close on that note, I want to reiterate what was said in the announcement, and that is the funding opportunity that's reflected in an all-payer approach, including support from the Veterans Health Administration and Medicaid admin money, if a state chooses to use it, is open to all states. However, if you're applying for Part A, one of the enhanced three-year grants, you have to bring the multiple payers to the table, and in fact, as a condition for being screened, you have to demonstrate that the state Medicaid agency is willing to work with the enhanced ADRC options counseling program to make state Medicaid FFP or FMAP investments in the infrastructure.
So just some final details for this call. Just a reminder in terms of dates, June 22nd is the letter of intent. July 11th is the due date for Part B. July 25th is the due date for Part A applications. This call is being recorded, and it will be posted with the application, with the funding opportunity announcement. And also with the funding opportunity announcement, we have a frequently asked questions, which all these questions will be added to that document. And then any additional questions, if you were unable to ask, if you send those to me, we'll make sure to add those to that document and provide a response. So we've reached, we're actually a little past 2 o'clock, but I want to thank you for being on this call, and feel free to send any additional questions to me. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Today's conference has ended. All participants may disconnect at this time.